The Southwest landscape of most of Paul Horgan's stories becomes programmatically biblical in his The Devil in the Desert, written in 1950. The main character is an old French priest, Louis Bellefontaine. Like his name, he is indeed a beautiful fountain in this harsh land. The story describes the old priest on his missionary's journey through the hard landscape, which becomes his way of the cross. The Devil in the Desert by Paul Horgan, dedicated to Virginia Rice. One summer morning, almost 100 years ago, in the town of Brownsville, near the mouth of the Rio Grande on the Gulf of Mexico, Father Pierre Arnold awoke before dawn in great distress. Yesterday, he said to himself bitterly, I should have told him yesterday. He listened in the dark of his room, whose little window was just showing the ghost of day over the gulf. Yes, he could hear what he dreaded to hear. Deep in the house were sounds of footsteps moving about. Father Pierre could tell where those steps went and what their maker was doing. Now he was in the study, taking up certain printed materials, a breviary, a missal, a handful of ornately printed blanks for baptism, marriages, and first communions, which could be filled in as occasion required. The footsteps receded toward the refectory, and there a battered leather knapsack soon was being filled with a cheese, 2 loaves of bread, a little sack of dried meal, a flask of red wine, and a jug of water. Presently a distant door opened and closed, and the footsteps went across the paved garden to the side door of the sacristy in the church, where another leather case would be stocked with sacred vessels, holy oils, communion wafers, and a set of vestments made in France of thin silk from Lyon. The sacristy door sounded again, and Father Pierre knew that the next stage of all these preparations for a journey would move out beyond the rectory and the church to the ragged field where in a corral the 2 priests of the parish kept their horses. There he knew Pancho, the 8-year-old gelding, who was the color of rusty weeds along the river, was going to be captured. After an absurd moment of delicacy and apprehension, saddled, and brought back to the courtyard where the saddlebags and knapsacks were waiting. By then it would be light enough outside to see where you were going. It would be time to go. From the sounds he could hear and the activities he could imagine, Father Pierre knew all over again something of the formidable man who was getting ready to depart. If those footsteps sounded like those of an old man trotting and tentative, yet there was in them a stubborn force. There was plain contempt for human comfort in the noise he made before dawn, when others might be sleeping. He seemed to say that if one man could get up and make all that noise in the name of God, then any other should be glad to awaken to it. Father Pierre knew there was grim joy in the world that morning for his friend and colleague, Father Louis Bellefontaine. He knew also that Father Louis tried to control a capacity for anger that could flare as quickly and madly as a cat's. In the new stone rectory, the 2 men lived harmoniously for the most part. It took much government of their natural temperaments to make this possible, for over everything lay the difficulty that Father Pierre, who was many years the younger, was the pastor, while Father Louis, who had come from France a generation before Father Pierre, was the assistant, and so subject to the orders of his junior. But they made jokes about this, as they did about Father Pierre's education. Father Louis knew only his God, his duties, and what he had learned from hard contests with nature. He knew it was proper for a fine gentleman like Father Pierre to be his superior, and he would wrinkle his old face with shrewd estimate and relish of silken details when Father Pierre was busy with narratives about life at home, which meant France, where one day, without doubt, the younger priest would be consecrated a bishop. But Father Louis never envied his superior anything, for he knew that in his own work he was a great master, a master of the distance, the heat, the fatigue, the menace of time in slow travel, the harsh vegetation of the brush desert, the ungoverned Indian whose soul was within him but not yet claimed, the fears, hopes, and needs of Mexican families, who live so widely separated along the inland course of the Rio Grande. For 30 years, Father Luis had ridden mostly alone, and twice a year on his journey up the river. He always undertook them with a sense not only of duty but of escape. Nowhere else did he feel so close to God as alone in the hard brush country, riding to bring comfort, news, and the sacraments to some family in a jacal hidden by solitude open to the hot sky. The older he grew, the more Father Luis longed for his escape from parish authority. The more infirm he became with the years, the stronger was his sense of mission. Father Pierre could see a glow of youth come back over that sun-stung, seamed old face as time drew near for Father Luis to make his plans to go on his ride into the upriver country, which would take him from 2 to 3 months. If his eyes were dim with age, not so the vision in his mind, which showed him so much of what people wanted of him and what he could bring to them. If his hand now trembled so that he could hardly write down the names and dates on one of his sacramental certificates, he could always joke about it and assure his families that the deed was recorded in heaven anyway. If sometimes his heart fluttered like a dusty bird in the cage of his ribs and made him wonder what was ready to take flight, he could lie down for a few minutes and feel the thing calm itself. And however unworldly he may have been, he always clamped his jaws together with sardonic satisfaction that his time had not yet quite come. He had things to do and would do them. Much of this was known to Father Pierre by intuition, and he recalled it as he arose this morning. He hastened, for if he was going to catch Father Luis and say to him what should have been said yesterday, and even long before that, he would have to hurry. Do you suppose it could be, thought Father Pierre, that I'm afraid of him? Or I afraid for my dignity? What if he simply will not listen to me? He's pretended before this to be deaf when he's preferred not to hear me. Or do I not want to see a look of pain in his old, small blue eyes? Actually, is there not a possibility that what I must tell him will shock him so that it might make him ill? Father Pierre shrugged angrily at his doubts and tried to answer them reasonably. Nonsense. After all, a letter from the bishop has approved my decision and given me authority for what is wise. Why must I heed for a second the individual feelings of anyone, myself included, when a duty is to be done? If I'd been a coward for days, in spite of all my prayers for strength and enlightenment on how best to do what needs doing, must I not be doubly strong today? And yet, as he went downstairs and out into the courtyard where a rosy daylight seemed to emerge from the ochre limestone of the church wall and glow in the very air, Father Pierre was as never before conscious of the difference in years between him and the old man, who was at this moment hauling at straps and buckles with one knee raised against Pancho's belly to brace himself. It was a picture, as Father Pierre could not help pausing to notice. The horse was laden, ready, and patient. His summer coat was nicely brushed, his bridle was of woven horsehair. His saddle was bulky and tall, with some of the leather worn away so that the wooden forms of horn and cantle showed through. That saddle was chair and pillow, living room and store to Father Luis. To it he had attached many ingenious and cranky accessories, among which there was nowhere any provision for carrying a weapon. Father Luis went unarmed. The old priest was dressed in a long homespun coat and heavy trousers. On his head was a woven cane hat with a wide brim under which his face, peering around at Father Pierre, looked like a crabapple underneath a shelf. His boots were high, the color of dried clay. Now, in the presence of the younger man, he redoubled his efforts at finishing his preparations. He made extra movements to show how difficult the job was, and he completed them with a little flourish to show how easily he overcame all. His breath went fast, making his voice dry and thin when he spoke. "Well, Pierre, I'm just about off. I'd hope I'd see you before I went." Father Pierre laughed. His heart beat. He said to himself, "Now, now, I must tell him now." But he heard himself reply only, "How do you think anybody could sleep with all your racket?" Ha! It was a dry and different comment.
And then Father Luis looked sharply into his superior's eyes.
What he saw there made him hurry. Well, I have everything. I'll send word back to you if I meet anybody coming this way. Yes, do, but before you go, Father Luis began to slip at his breast pockets with sudden dismay. Oh, Pierre, think of it. I nearly forgot my sunglasses. The new ones, you know, the pair which my niece sent me from Vitry du François. I've seen them, yes. They have green glass and metal rims, I believe. The ones. You'd be good angel to just get them for me. They must be in my room. You'll wait for me? But of course, I'll be right back.
How could it be? And yet it was. Father Pierre, at the very point of discharging his sorry duty, was sent off on an errand by his victim. He shook his head. What did he fear so? The acid rage of Father Luis? The years of unspoken submission of the older man to the younger? The human aches that can invade the hearts of even those promised to God? He didn't know. All he could believe was that the unshaven, knobbled old man, waiting down there by his packed horse, with his hands that trembled on a regular slow beat and his old blue eyes, was stronger than he. Father Pierre was tall and slender and chiseled in man's noble likeness. His soutane was always clean. His white face and dark eyes could blaze with the Holy Ghost. He had a proper respect for authority, but could not now use his own. Lifting piles of paper and putting aside apples that had dried up, and mineral specimens blanched by dust, he searched Father Louis's room for the green sunglasses, with their oval lenses and tin rims. He smiled at the condition of the room. He could not find the glasses. He returned to the courtyard. Father Luis was already in his saddle. In his hands he held the sunglasses. I found them. I'm sorry you had to go for them. Goodbye, Pierre. Give me your blessing. I must be getting along now. Through his thin old voice and his clouded eyes, there spoke a boy who was off on a picnic. Father Pierre's heart sank as he looked at him. He knew now that he was not going to tell him what it was his duty to tell. Chagrined at his own weakness and touched by the joy in the face of the impatient old man, he lifted his hand and blessed him with the sign of the cross, to which Father Luis bent his body, leaning forward with the elegance which, no matter what they may be on the ground, men used to the saddle assume the minute they are mounted. Then, with a tart smile on his face, under the woven cane hat, Father Luis waved grandly to his superior, turned his reins, and at a rapid, hilarious walk, was taken by his willing horse out of the courtyard and down the road toward the river, where the first light of the sun lapped at the brown, ruffled water, which came from so far beyond even the country where he was going. After all these years, he had a map in his head. The river came on a long diagonal, so. An old Indian trail went off northwestward at another angle, so. The farther inland, the farther apart they were from one another. There was one kind of country here by the seacoast. Presently, it changed to another kind. Finally, in the distance of weeks, where the map would have been only faltering scratches of the pen, based on rumor and legend, lay the farthest wilderness of Father Luis's journey. The natural limits of his endurance were determined by water. His private map had an X for the end of each stage of travel. A settlement, a farm, a creek, a spring, a waterhole, and pray it was not dry. For the first several days on these journeys, he hardly seemed to have left home. The earth was still low and sandy, and he could read in it how epochs ago the sea itself was here, hauling and grinding the stuff of ocean bottoms where he now rode. The air was moist, and little clouds came to be and to vanish almost before his gaze. He could not closely follow the river, for it wandered and turned in some places, doubling back upon itself in its last exhausted efforts to reach the sea. And so he followed the Indian trail, leaving it only to go to the isolated river farms in turn. As such a one, he might spend the night, or longer, depending on what he found. Sometimes death approached in the family, and he gave the last sacraments. Sometimes there were infants to baptize. In the mornings, under a tree at rough-hewn planks set across a pair of hogshead, he would say Mass and give communion. He listened to the local news from Mexico across the Rio Grande. There was talk of another war between the ranchers of Coahuila and the Mexican troops. It had not rained for 170 days. Robbers came over the river a while back and killed 4 men here in Texas, and stole some cattle and horses and went back across the river. A child was born in the Bolson del Mapimi, who spoke quite clearly at 3 days old of a flood that would come, but who, when further questioned, seemed to have lost the power of speech, and so on. Father Luis, in his turn, told how things were at Brownsville, and farther up the coast at Corpus Christi and Galveston, and across the sea in France, where under the new emperor business was booming, and trade with Mexico was growing, as you could tell by the many ships that came from Marseille and Le Havre into the Gulf of Mexico. And then, after receiving gifts of food from such a family, the rider would leave the river and return to the trail, going northwestward once more. Days later, though the sky did not cool during the daytime, the quality of the heat changed and was dry as the old seacoast plain gave way to a wilderness of rolling country thickly covered with thorny brush. When he encountered it as he wandered, the riverbed was rocky, and rock showed through the hard, prickly ground. Everywhere he looked, he saw only that endless roll of empty land. Here, near to him, it was speckled with the colors of the olive, both green and ripe, but not with any of the grace he remembered from long ago in southern France, where the olive trees gave a silver sweetness to the landscape. Farther away in the distance, the land rolls swam in glassy heat. Way off at the horizon, there was a stripe of hazy blue, where the hot white sky met the earth. Nowhere could he see a mountain, either in Mexico or in Texas. As he rode, the country tried to hold him back. The thorns of the mesquite dragged at his boots and tore his clothes. Pancho was clever at avoiding most of the hazards, but in places these were so thick that all they could do, man and horse, was to go slowly and stoutly through them. But this was nothing new. Father Luis had persisted before against the thorns and had prevailed. As for water, there was always too much or too little. Too little when, after years of drought, certain springs he looked forward to would, as he came upon them, reveal only dried white stone. Too little after years of drought. Certain springs he looked forward to would, as he came upon them, reveal only dried white stones. Too much when, in hot spells so violent they could only be ended with violence, there would be a cloudburst, and the heavens would fall almost solid, and bring the first water, which, as it struck the baked earth, actually hissed and made cracking sounds, until the vanished desert was slaked enough to receive water in its fissures and let it run. When it ran in such quantity, every finger-like draw became a torrent, in which a man and a horse could easily be drowned. If he crossed one in safety, another was waiting to engulf him beyond the next roll. There was no place for shelter. When the rain stopped, the sun came back and dried everything the same day except the running arroyos, which went dry the next day. All too soon there was bitter dust that sparkled in the light and rose with a hot wind. Against it, Father Luis tied across his face his great bandana that came from New Orleans. And they went on, making a small shadow of horse and man, moving slowly yet certainly, across that huge empty map, where days apart, each from the other, little clusters of human life in need clung to being, and shone in Father Luis' mind and purpose like lanterns in the darkness, which was usually the first image he saw of his destination, when by his reckoning it was time to reach another of his families. Was this a hard journey? Very well, then, it was a hard journey. But so was the life hard that he found at the end of each stage of his travels. He had seen men grow old and die in his visits here, and their sons with their wives bring new souls to this wilderness in turn. They learned severe lessons in isolation, heat, and hostility of the animal and vegetable world. Everyone, the child, the grandfather, the husband, the wife, the youth, the horse, the maiden, worked unceasingly against dust, thorn, ignorance, and scarcity from dawn to dusk. The great world was but a rumor here, and by the time he came to the brush deserts, mostly wrong. But a world without limits of dimension dwelt behind the eyes of all those parched brown people, obedient to the natural terms of their lives. It was the world of the human soul in which the betrayals of impersonal nature could be survived, if only someone came from time to time with the greatest news in all life. For Father Luis knew in a simple flatness of fact, fact as hard as rock, as mysterious as water, as unrelenting as light, that without God the richest life in the world was more arid than the desert, and with him the poorest life was, after all, complete in a harmony that composed all things. To be the agent of such a composition put upon him a duty, in the light of which all peril of his journeys became at worst mere inconvenience. Everyone he toiled over land to sea needed and deserved that which he, at the moment under existing circumstances, alone could bring.
In a practical way, he was still awed by the mystery of his office. And as a human being, he could never deny himself the joy it gave him to see in their faces what his coming meant to his people in the harsh wilderness. They knew what he had come through. They were proud to be thought worth such labor and danger. His mind was active in the solitude through which he crawled day after day, mounted on Pancho. One of his favorite fancies was this, that a great triangle existed between God in heaven and any little ranch toward which he rode through the days and himself. It was an always changing triangle, for one of its points was not fixed, his own. As he came nearer and nearer to his goal of the moment, the great hypotenuse between himself and God grew shorter and shorter, until at the last, when he arrived, there was a straight line with all in achieved communion. He smiled over this idea, but he respected it too, and sometimes he would take a piece of charcoal from a fire and draw a series of pictures of what he meant, explaining it to the people he was visiting, and they would murmur and nod and consult each other and enjoy the notion with him marveling. One day at noon on the present journey, he knew he should see soon what would look like a long, thin blade of cloud shadow far ahead on the earth that slowly quivered with wafts of light like those in wavering mirrors. But it was not a cloud shadow. As he had found out nearly 30 years ago, it was the distant gash of a long canyon whose yellow rock walls were stained with great stripes of slate blue. It came from the north and far away to the south, opened into the rocky trough of the Rio Grande. In its bottom were all the signs of a river, but running water. Here and there were shallow pools, fed by the underground flow that needed stormwater to call it flowingly to the surface. Father Luis always paused at such a pool for a bath. There were sores on his body from the catch of thorns through which he rode. Sometimes a needle of the brush would break in his flesh and burrow its way under his skin. For the most part, he was unaware of such an affliction, but by its comfort, the warm alkaline water of the pool reminded him of the misery he had forgotten to notice. It was usually mid-afternoon by the time he reached the canyon wall as the sun would lower. This place was like a palace to him, open to the brassy sky.
Wrens and hawks came to look at him in their wary turns. To be below the surface of the rolling plain in the canyon was to have for a little while the luxury of privacy somehow. He bathed and dozed as he dried, and sat in the shade reading his breviary. He knew when it was just time to gather himself together and resume his ride in order to come by nightfall to the house in spring of Encarnadino Guerra, where he would spend the night. This friend was a boy of 10 when Father Luis first met him. He was now the father of 6 children, the husband of a silent, smiling woman named Cipriana, the son of a widowed mother called Donna Luz, who on his last visit told Father Luis that she would not live to enjoy his next one. He remembered how she sat blinking in the brilliant shade of the desert, bowing to him over and over, while a triumph of patience went over her face, eroded by time and trouble and work and pain, as she said, "At night, when everything is quiet, and I am awake and alone, for I cannot sleep much anymore, something speaks to me and tells me to be ready and not make any other plans."
She looked at him with hardly any light in her small eyes, and he knew she was right. When he said Mass for them that time, he thought he saw in her face some powerful, direct understanding of the Holy Sacrifice, which during all her pious life had slumbered within her, but which at last came clear in her whole small, withered being. He wondered whether, through any dry, desert-like tenacity, she might still be living. But when he rode up in the arching twilight to the dwelling of the Guerras, almost the first thing they told him after their excited greeting was that Donna Luz had died early in the summer, while sitting in the shade on her bench holding her stick of acotillo wood, in which her hands had shined so smooth. In the light of the candle lantern, the family looked at him and then at each other. They were shocked by how he had changed since last year. He was stooped, and he slowly trembled all the time. He had to peer at them to see them, even though he preserved a smile to make nothing of this. Burned by the wind and sun, his face looked smaller. He breathed shallowly, with his mouth a little open. He seemed to them a very old man, all of a sudden. It was like a secret they must keep from him. After their first start, they got busy making his supper. The youngest children lost their shyness and came to him from behind chairs and the edges of the table to see him, and at last to climb upon him. He smelled dry and dusty to them, like the earth. After supper, he held lessons in catechism for the younger children, who tomorrow would receive their first communions. The parents and the 2 older sons listened also.
After that, there was little time left for gossip. The family's news was all of the seasons. The priest was boiled down out of letters and newspapers from France. The Guerras already knew that the earthly love of his life was in his native country, which he had not seen for over 30 years, but which still spoke in his darting eyes, his cleverness at description, and in the accent with which he spoke Spanish. They listened respectfully while he made picture after picture in his talk of what he loved and missed. But they could not really see with him either the cool green fields, the ancient stone farmhouses, the lanes of poplar trees, the clear rivers, or the proud old towns, or the towering cathedrals, or the silvery web of his city of Paris, sparkling delicately in daytime, glowing in the long dusk with golden lamps and violet distance. But they were honored simply to have him here, and stared before his marvels, and held their breath for tomorrow, when he would give them sacraments. In the morning he visited the grave of Doña Luz. Everybody went with him. She was buried a little way off from the adobe house. When he saw how little earth she displaced, he nodded and smiled, as though meeting all over again her modest character, which he knew so well. Guerra brought some water in an earthen vessel, not much, but enough. Father Luis took the jug and held it in both hands a moment and gazed into it. They were all reminded of how precious water was on the earth, how determined by its presence, the very presence of life. Then he blessed it, and they all knew what this meant in terms of their daily struggle. Then, reciting prayers for the dead, he walked around the small mound of the grandmother and sprinkled the holy water on it. And they knew he was affirming once again a promise made between heaven and earth a long time ago. After that, they returned to the house, and he took them one by one and heard them confess their sins, of which, as they were contrite, he relieved them. Then, at an altar improvised against the wall, where the old woman used to sit for so many hours, he said Mass, wearing his embroidered French silks and using the pewter chalice that came out of his saddlebag. The family knelt on the ground in a long straight line facing the altar. The famous triangle of Father Luis was brought into a straight line also. God and mankind were made one. As he recited the words during the offertory, O God, who has established the nature of man in wondrous dignity and even more wondrously has renewed it, Father Luis felt behind him the bodily presence of that isolated family, and an almost bitter sense of the dearness of each of their souls humbled him at his altar.
When Mass was over, they returned within the house, where at the raw table polished by countless unnoticed contacts of all the family, Father Luis sat down to fill in certificates of First Communion for the younger children. He had a flask of Guasacha ink and a German steel pen. Sitting as far back from the documents as he could, the better to read, he began to write. A look of disgust came over his face as his trembling hand gave him trouble. Exclaiming impatiently, he put his left hand on his right wrist to add strength and steadiness where they were needed. But this did not help much, and when he was done, he pushed the papers toward the head of the family, saying, Nobody can ever read my writing except God. They all took him seriously, prouder than before of their papers. But that's enough, isn't it? He demanded in comic ferocity. They had a merry breakfast when all talked as though they would not soon again have a chance to talk, which was true. All except Guerra, who was going to speak of something as soon as he built up enough of his own silence. Finally, he was ready. Father, he said, leaning back a trifle in his chair and half-closing his eyes to disguise deep feelings. You won't be going on anywhere else after us, will you? Oh, yes. Where will you go, Father? Well, I plan to ride from here over toward the river. I have a couple of families over there. And I may go as far as the town of San Ignacio to see if the priests from Mier are making their visits there as they ought to. Why? Guerra put his head on one side and shrugged. He did not want to say that the old man was exhausted and ought not to go so far in the pitiless country under the searing sun. It would not be polite to say the old man was older than his years, and he must be 70 anyway. He might be misunderstood if he said that everybody reached a time after a life of hard work when he must pause and rest and let stronger people do what it needed doing. It would hardly do to show outright he thought Father Luis should give up and stay here and rest a few weeks. And then perhaps Encarnación Guerra might leave everything here in the hands of his two strong, quiet boys and just ride with Father Luis until he saw him safely back into Brownsville. Father Luis peered close to his younger friend and saw enough of these thoughts to stir him up.
Hey, he said, rapping hard with his knuckles on Guerra's skull. What goes on in there? He was sharp and angry. What were they all thinking? That he was a feeble old man? He knew all there was to know about that. But if anything was to be said, he, not they, or anyone else, was the one to say it. Mind your manners, boy, he said to Guerra, screwing up his small eyes until all that showed of them were two sharp blue points of light.
Eh? You have opinions, have you? Who told you to think anything, eh? When I want you to think anything about anybody, I'll tell you, eh? I got here, didn't I? How many times have I managed to come, and what for? Does anybody tell me to come, or where to go, or when, or why? Then you keep your place and thank God for your blessings, and for your friends, and understand that it is just as bad to hold an impolite thought as it is to say an impolite thing, eh?
His whole body shook with a passion he failed to control.
Bad. You better just be careful. That's all I have to say to you here. The family was appalled at this burst of feeling. They sat with downcast eyes, fearing that it would be disrespectful to look upon Father Luis in his rage. But they had little glimpses of his unshaven face whitened with anger, and they could hear how pulse-shaken his voice was. Guerra was more Indian than anything else, and his countenance became fixed. He leaned back, let his eyelids cut his gaze in half, took his dressing down without response. He was not even hurt by it. He knew why it came to him. He knew how much it proved him right in his concern. He admired the flare of spirit in the old man. He was at peace with himself for trying what he had tried. The youngest child, not understanding what had taken place, now belatedly felt the emotion among all the older ones.
And turning up her little clay doll face, She burst into wails of misery and fear, bringing her tiny creature paws to her howling mouth until she resembled the small sculptured masks of earth buried with the dead centuries ago deep in Mexico. Father Luis roughly took her upon his lap. He bent his bristly face close to hers, cactus and blossom together, and in barely audible murmurs quieted the child and himself, which took about 5 minutes. This act reclaimed them all for each other. Once again, the visitor was kind and smiling, and the family without fear. "And so goodbye for this time," said Father Luis, putting the child down and standing up. "If you will get my horse for me?" Guerra spoke to one of the boys who went to fetch Pancho. They all met him outside. Cipriana brought some tortillas for the saddlebag. Everyone knelt down to be blessed. The hot sunlight smote them. They had lingered over their breakfast. It was late. Father Luis mounted and ready, blessed them 3 times, and then turned and rode off to the south. After a while, he looked back. They were still kneeling. The next time he looked back, it was hard to see them, for even at a little distance, they made the same shadows as the scrubby bushes that grew on the caked earth and seemed just as eternally rooted there. He had a bad morning. The sun seemed hotter to him than before. The savage brush seemed animated with spite as it clawed at his legs going by. Pancho, after a lifetime in the brush country, took it into his head to be terrified of familiar things, and from time to time, without warning, executed a rapid dance step to one side, while throwing his head back and rolling his eyes at his rider.
"Hush, you fool!" Father Luis exclaimed at such times. "You fool!" But he addressed himself as much as he did the horse.
For the first few hours of that day's ride, he reviewed many times the loss of his temper at Guerra, and developed a masterly case, closely reasoned, lucid as only a French argument could be, compassionate with a largeness of heart, yet as logical as music in its progression, about why it had been not only natural but actually necessary to reprove Guerra for having presumed whole views about him. Reproof? Perhaps actually more of a scolding? Scolding? Thinking it over, possibly even a tongue-lashing. And the knuckles? The furious raps on the head? Still, how else could he be made to understand? But understand what? It was no good. As he always did, in the end, he lost the argument with himself. He knew that after hours of exhausting search for conclusions that would excuse him for what he had done, he would at last come to the truth, which was that he had offended God and man through his lifelong besetting sin of pride, self-esteem, an attempted condonement of his own shortcomings, and there would be nothing left to do but go down on his knees and admit how wrong he had been and pray to be forgiven and to be granted strength once more to conquer himself. He began his penance with a resolve not to eat or drink until nightfall. By mid-afternoon the brush grew thicker. Only occasional did he come to a little clearing between the mesquite bushes, which rose higher than himself, mounted on Pancho. In spite of his green sunglasses, the ground sparkled and glared enough to hurt his eyes. He watched for, but he could not see, the long pale blur, which would tell him that another canyon lay ahead, which he would follow until it took him finally to the Rio Grande. He kept the sun on his right, for it was declining in the west in the white sky, and he was going south. The day was still. He thought that he heard a singing wind, but when he tried to notice whether he could feel the air stirring or see dust rising ahead of him, there was no sign of wind. He halted Pancho. What did he hear then? He turned his head. Yes, he could hear something now, very far ahead, now here, in his very ear. He searched the undulating horizon, but he saw nothing except the wavering image of heat where the white sky met the dusty earth. As he rode on, the singing in the air became louder. It sounded like the voice of the desert heat. He shook his head, resentful of natural conditions that hid behind mystery. And then suddenly he knew,
and scornfully he rebuked himself for taking so long about it. He was riding into a swarm of cicadas, and now he could see the first ones clinging to the mesquite as they raised their shrieking song of the heat. The farther he rode, the louder they became. He bent his head under their stinging assault upon his hearing. There were thousands and millions of them. Blindly they fulfilled their natures in their collective scream of response to the sun and the desert. The very atmosphere seemed to be in flames, and the sound of the stridulating insects added to the illusion. Father Luis had touched the desert often enough. He had smelled it, he had tasted it, when its dust rose on the wind. He had seen it in every state, but never before in so real a sense had he heard it. He was suddenly exhausted. In a clearing, a little lake of baked dust a few yards in diameter, he halted and dismounted, tying Pancho to a stout mesquite branch. Disturbed, a cloud of cicadas rose on cackling threads of flight and found another bush. The ringing song rose all about him. He could not even hear the sound of Pancho stamping his foot to shake off flies. He clapped his hands, but barely made a sound against the strident song in the air. He felt removed from himself. All desert natures combined to render him impersonal. Here, humbled, not only from within but from without, he could find real contrition. He knelt down to pray. Sunlight was brilliant in the center of the clearing. A little open room, hidden by time, distance, and mesquite clumps. At the west side of it there was lacy shade, cast by tall bushes. But Father Luis rejected it and knelt in the plain sunlight. He bent his head under the beat of his spirit and the insect scream that seemed to invoke the zenith. He prayed to be forgiven for his miserable anger. His thoughts came alive in French, the language through which he had first met God. He was not long now in his contrition, for he knew that a prayer was not so often a matter of length, but of depth. Much sober, even saddened by his intense self-discovery, he rose wearily from his knees and went over to the shade to lie down. He went as deeply as he could into the underboughs of the thorny mesquite. He closed his eyes. At once he felt cooler, just to have the hot light shaded from his sight. Ah, this was delicious. Just to lie for a few moments and gather strength to go on for the remaining hours of daylight. He felt how his limbs all went heavy on the earth as he drifted off to sleep. Little coins of light fell over him through the intricate branches. Where he lay, he made solid shadow himself under the mesquite tree. He was as quiet and substantial as a rock. It in turn used him without his knowing, for he was asleep. He did not see or smell or feel what came in slow inquiry along the trackless ground. Striving forward in orderly, powerful progress, flowing in a dry glitter, and advancing through always new and always repeated thrust of form from side to side and yet ahead. It was a diamondback rattlesnake, in search of shade and cool. It came from deep in the scattered brush, and it found the heavy sleeping man under the bushy tree with what seemed almost conscious caution against awakening the sleeper. The snake drew closer and closer in infinite delicacy, until in the shade of Father Luis's right shoulder it lay heavily at rest, its length doubled back and forth in inert splendor. The sleepers did not stir for a while, and then Father Luis grew tense in dream, his mouth fell open. And awakening with a jerk, he sat up, lost in forgetfulness of where he was or how he came there. He stared at the white sky. The thick snake, at the first quiver of motion beside itself, drew instantly into its coil and shook its dozen rattles. Their dry buzz could not be heard over the general din of the cicadas. Ah, yes, sighed Father Luis, as he discovered where he was and why and whither he was going. He put his hand to his brow and sank roughly back to earth to take a few more minutes of rest. The snake struck him in the shoulder and struck him again. His coils turned dust into liquid light as they lashed. The strikes came like blows made by the thick, powerful arm of a young man.
What then? Said Father Luis, at the sudden stabbing pain and the blows that shook him. He first thought of the mesquite thorns on a springy branch that were long, and, as he had often said, sharp as fangs, and their prick could fester if not treated. It occurred to him that this would be troublesome now, as he could hardly reach his own shoulder to wash, cut open the skin, and dig out the thorns, if they had broken to stay in the flesh. But he turned to see the branch that had attacked him, and saw the snake instead. The snake was retreating. He could see its eye with its glaring drop of light. His heart began to beat hard. He had a surge of rage. He wanted to kill the snake, and actually rose to one knee and scraped the ground with his hands for something to attack with. A rock, a club, a dead wood, anything. But he could find nothing. But he sank down again.
And out of habit in any crisis,
brought his hands together with the crossed thumbs in the attitude of prayer. No, no, no anger. He besought himself with eyes shut. He had just endured and come through a storm of his own pride, and he must not now create another. He opened his eyes and looked after the snake and saw where it paused, half in, half out of the dappled shade of the next bush. Go, he said to it. What he meant by this came to be more and more clear through calm and struggle in the next hour or so. The snake, as though it had heard him, resumed in infinite slowness the gliding flow of its retreat,
until it was lost to sight among the hot thickets,
where the insects still sang and sang.
Yes, go,
he repeated bitterly, and was ashamed to discover that he was trembling. It was the humanity in him that shook because death was coming.
He fell over upon his face and put his cracked and dusty hands over his eyes.
His mouth was open, and he took into it the loose acid earth with his breath. His tears ran down his fingers. His heart was pounding rapidly upon the ground. It seemed to shake the earth. It told Father Luis that he was afraid.
Afraid of what? He thought.
Afraid of death, but I've dealt with it all my life, and I've robbed it of its terrors for those who knew how to die. Is death the only victory of life? Or do we have to defeat life in its own terms?
That depends.
It depends on whether sin is ever outside oneself, or always within. Yes, this is a very interesting matter. He made himself lay quietly without any thought for a moment. If perhaps he conserved his energy, he might, by natural vitality, by pure goodness, defeat the murder that had been dealt him by the desert. He forced himself to relax, and promised that in a little while his head would be clearer, his heart would calm itself, and moving with infinite caution, he would rise, mount his horse, and go slowly, steadily, cleverly toward the long evening, and come to the canyon where there must be a familiar trickle of water, and come to friends who would know how to make poultices, and feed him and recover him to the use and enjoyment of many more years of duty, work, and acquired merit.
But the poison worked rapidly,
and he felt it charging his mind with throbbing pain that confused him. Shining bars went across his vision behind his eyes like spokes of a great wheel. He was dazzled by their power. When he raised his head, they took it with him.
Rolling and rolling, he fell down upon the ground, where his cheek was cut by little pebbles of gypsum.
He tried to say, "Let me not live for vanity, though, Lord." Questions now became academic, for he went blind in his inner vision, and lay trembling as the terrible message had been stricken into him, touched, traveled the course of his blood, and reached him everywhere within. Tied to his mesquite tree, Pancho stamped and waited. Presently, Father Luis believed that he awoke. His mind was working sharply, and with what seemed to him exquisite new ease and clarity. He saw all his thoughts, as in crystal depths of cold, fresh water. He knew he was in the mesquite thicket, and what had happened to him, and he possessed this knowledge with an elated purity, such as he had always known in the state of grace after receiving or administering the sacraments. It was more than mere physical well-being. It was a sense of delivery from the ordinary guilt of his own clay and the exasperating weight of the world.
It was the real meaning of communion with all that lay beyond himself. In such a state, truth needed no seeking and no definition. It was here within, and it was there without. It was everywhere. When all was known, there could be no astonishment.
He was therefore not astonished now, when right before him, lying at ease in the light of the sun,
was the snake gazing at him with piercing sweetness. He spoke to it, "I do not hate you. It is enough that I recognize you." The snake replied, "That is my damnation."
"Yes," said Father Louise, "for when evil is recognized, all other powers move together to defeat it."
"And yet they never do defeat it, do they? How do you explain that?"
"Ah, you and I do not see it in quite the same way. You conceive of the possible death of evil as being one final end after which only goodness will survive?"
"I do."
"That is your vanity. For the fact is that evil must be done to death over and over again with every act of life. One might even say that this repeated act is a very condition for the survival of life itself. For only by acts of growth can more life be made, and if all evil, all acts of death were ended once and for all, there'd be nothing left for the soul to triumph over in repeated acts of growth." The snake sighed despondently and said,
"Do you not permit me a comparable purpose and privilege? That is of triumphing repeatedly over all acts of good. That is of life until only I remain."
"I permit you your established role, but I do not admit the possibility of your triumphing repeatedly over all acts of life. I must point out that historically your premise is untenable."
"And yet I've played a part in every human life."
"Oh, admittedly, we're not discussing the fact that your powers exist, only the fact that they have their limits." The snake smiled.
"This from you?"
it asked with ironic politeness. "What do you mean, sir?"
"If my powers have their limits, how is it that I have killed you? What greater power is there than that?"
Father Louis passed his hand across his face to hide his amusement. "You have betrayed the weakness of your whole position," he replied. "For it appears to be impossible for you to know that the death of matter is of no importance except to other matter. The materialist can see only destruction as the logical end of his powers. I and my brothers and my children know that beyond matter lies spirit, and that it is there where answers are found. And truths become commonplace. And such efforts as yours, so restless, so ingenious, so full of torturing vanity, are seen for what they really are." The snake frowned for a moment, but then shook off its irritation and said again, with politeness, even with a charm and appeal that Father Louise was the first to admit,
"Everyone must do that which his nature dictates."
"There again," said Father Louise with assumed gravity, "there is much behind the formation of that nature which you do not take into account."
"Oh, come, after all, I'm a snake. I came from snakes. I do a snake's work. How could I behave like anything else but a snake?
The outward form is hardly the point. You can assume any form you choose, I believe." The snake hesitated before answering. A gleam of admiration went through its expression, and it marveled frankly for a moment at the astuteness of Father Louis.
"I must say, even if we're enemies, you forced me to admire and like you," it said.
"Thank you," said Father Louis. "Viewed abstractly, you have great and beautiful qualities of your own."
"Oh, do you really think so?"
"Oh, yes, I do. But I must add that they seem to be less important, and in the end, than they do to you."
"Oh, you can be very rude, you know."
"I do not think of it in that way," said Father Louis mildly. "Finally, it doesn't matter how things are said or done. It's what things are said or done. For example, I really believe you can do things far more expertly than I can. But when it comes to what things, there I have you."
The snake looked away, far from pleased.
Father Louise resumed. I can't assume any form, for example, as you can. I always remain what I am, a man, an old man, a dirty old man, when water is scarce or I'm busy, or an old man full of pride and sin and vanity and all the rest, but nobody is ever in doubt about what I mean, about what I think life means. And with all my mistakes and style and good form, the garden I scratch keeps growing. And I? And you. Sometimes you're a snake, and sometimes a whisper. And again a daydream, a lump in the blood, a sweet face, an ambition, a scheme for making money, a task for an army. Sometimes you can even be a man and disarm everyone who cannot see your heart. But someone there is who always sees. Goodness is often performed without the slightest knowledge of its doing. But evil is always known. Yes, I think more people know me than the other thing. But don't congratulate yourself upon that, said Father Louise. For it always means one of your uncountable defeats when you are known. Father Louise saw that the snake would have to grow angry unless the subject were changed. The snake changed it. I wonder, it mused, why I ever came to you today. Father Louise shrugged. Sooner or later we would have come together, he said. Did you expect me? I have been expecting you all my life, though not exactly in this particular guise. You came to me in my sleep like an evil dream. All I wanted was a little comfort. It was so hot, so dry. Father Louise smiled in delight. You see, for comfort, even you have to appeal to the powers of goodness. The snake habitually wore a scowling smile, and now for a moment the smile disappeared, leaving only the scowl. Then, with an effort, it restored the smile and said,
Why did you let me go?
I had no weapon.
You could have stamped on me.
I do not believe in killing.
Yet I am your enemy.
Yes, you are, but I believe there are greater ways to dispose of you than in revenge.
You do not have much time left, you know. Just think of all the time you would have left if I had not come to you, if you had seen me and killed me first.
Yes, I have thought of that, but you speak as though time were my property. It is not. How can I count it, or know how much of it is my share? The snake frowned and looked from side to side evasively. Unwillingly, against its own comfort, it asked,
Who else can decide your share? Where did you get it? What do you refer to?
The snake began uneasily to bring its coils together. There was anguish in its movement, slow as it was. It seemed to be obeying desire. It was hurtful, and yet impossible to deny.
You do not really want to hear, said Father Louise tenderly.
Oh, yes, I do. Tell me,
said the snake, with broken breath, already suffering under the answer it demanded. Father Louise bent over the snake with compassion. There was torture in the creature, as with glittering sweet power it begged Father Louise to answer.
Very well, my poor sinner, said Father Louise gravely.
I and all creatures draw our share of time in this life from God, our Father in heaven. At these words, the snake, with speed of lightning, new convulsions in its dread coils, and with mouth wide open and fangs exposed, struck again and again at the earth, where the dust rose like particles of gold and silver. Father Louise regarded it with pity as its paroxysm of hatred and chagrin spent itself. At last, gasping softly and stretched out in exhaustion, the snake said sorrowfully,
And so it was not by my will that you die now.
No. I was only the means. Only the means.
Your hour was designated elsewhere?
Father Louise looked upward. His face was radiant. My hour was fixed by our Heavenly Father. The snake closed its eyes and shuddered reminiscently. Then it said,
And my hour?
You will die in your bodily form by His will.
You're sure?
Yes, but you will live only on earth, no matter what form you assume. The snake grew pale.
Oh, no.
Yes, said Father Louise, as his argument drew to its close,
for there can be no evil in heaven. The snake lay with its mouth open, its tongue like a little tongue of fire flickering in despair. its eyes staring without sight. It was vanquished, destroyed, made trivial. Father Luis shook his head over it and wished it might not have suffered. Then he felt his brow, where the diamondine lucidity of the past quarter of an hour seemed to be clouding over. His skull was cracking under blows that beat and beat there. How could he feel so ill after feeling so well? "And now you must excuse me," he said uncertainly to the snake. "I have things to do, and actually I do not feel too well, thank you. If you will just go now," and he looked to see if the snake was leaving, but the snake was already gone. The battering pains in his head brought Father Luis from vision to consciousness. "Oh, my God," he said devoutly and with much effort, even with modesty representing his trouble to him whose suffering he had dwelt upon so deeply in a lifetime. He looked around. The air seemed entirely silent. This was because there was a ringing in his head, so bewildering that he could no longer hear the myriad insects at their screaming celebration of the heat. He saw Pancho tied to the tree. "No, you must not stay with me," he said, and tried to stand up. He could barely stand, for his legs were weak as paralysis crept into him. And so he crawled across the open place among the thickets until he could hold to his stirrup, haul himself up, and lean with his head on the saddle for a moment. "You need not die here tied to a tree," he said. "Let me get my things, and you may go." He fumbled with the buckets. He fumbled with the buckles and straps until he was able to haul the saddle off the horse. It fell to the ground. He worked at the bridle until he had freed it enough to pull it over Pancho's head. The horsehair bridle hung from the thorny tree and trailed into the dust. "Hiya, hiya," said Father Luis, waving his hand at Pancho to make him trot away, as he so often had done after unsaddling the horse at the corral in Brownsville. But Pancho simply stood and regarded him. "Very well, very well. In your own time, then," he said, and went down to his hands and knees, fondling a pouch on the saddle. Out of it and into his hands came the objects he wished to hold once more. Holding them to his breast, he crawled back to his fatal shade across the clearing. The sun was almost down. "Magnificat anima Dei Dominum," he murmured, while the pain pierced him through and through. "Et exultavit spiritus meus in Deo salutari meo," he said without knowing he spoke. But he brought a lifetime of prayer with him to death's door, and a little while it entered there with him. Pancho, late the next evening, finished finding his way through the brush back to the house of Encardino Guerra. The family saw that he was without his saddle and bridle. Guerra and his big son went searching, and though they persevered for days, found nothing in that wilderness of repeated clump and glaring shadow and lost sameness. They had to give up. Later that year, when surveyors from an expedition of the United States Army came by his place on their way to Brownsville, Guerra told them the news and asked him to see that it reached the proper authorities, along with the horse Pancho, who he hoped they would take with them. And then one day, years afterward, Guerra was on his way to San Ignacio on the Rio Grande to see his new grandson, born to the household of his oldest boy, who now lived there. Coming into a small clearing in the brush, he found, quite by accident, what he had looked for long ago. There was not much left, for the desert earth and sky were voracious. Coyotes and blowing sand, vultures and beating sunlight, and the wind had worked with the years on flesh and leather, French silk, parchment, and homespun. Reverently, Guerra took up the few bones that had not been scattered, and the few hard things that still stayed by them, the pewter chalice, a rosary of small seashells, 3 American silver dollars, the pair of green sunglasses, and, from a mesquite tree where it hung now off the ground, the horsehair bridle. When he could, he made the journey to Brownsville, bringing the relics of his old friend with him. He found his way to Father Pierre Arnaud. "How these things speak to us," said Father Pierre, after hearing the end of the story that had begun 8 years before. He looked at Guerra and saw that this was a man who had lost a dear friend. Who would understand anything said to him in the name of Father Luis? He added,
I'm leaving soon for France. Do you know where that is?
Oh, yes, he used to tell us much about it. Father Pierre was making ready to obey a summons to return to receive the dignity of bishop of a French diocese. I'm going there to assume new work, he said. These things, the sacrifice, he said, indicating what Guerra had brought, will help me do it better. Guerra nodded. We will bury him here in the churchyard, continued Father Pierre, and you must be present as you were his friend and have served him so well now. I would like to ask your permission to keep this. He held up the little string of seashells. Yes, said Guerra, accepting with simplicity the power to dispose. I wonder how he died, murmured Father Pierre. Indians? A heart attack? No Indians. Why not? They would not have let the horse go. True, what then? Guerra made a gesture with his mouth, putting his lips forward as though he would point to a place from there and long ago. He saw the clearing in the thorny bush again, and knew its nature, all of it. I think I know. How could you possibly? He did not die suddenly, no. No, he had time to free his horse. If he had thought he could have saved himself, he would have come with the horse, undoubtedly. But he did not come, he stayed. That means he knew there wasn't any use. And so, where I found him was just like the place where it would happen. What would happen? With his hand, Guerra made in the air a slow, sinuous motion from side to side, an unmistakable imitation. No, said Father Pierre, a snake? Guerra nodded. I think so, he said. Father Pierre shuddered at the nature of that fate, and then presently he kindled at the memory of an old weakness and an old strength. Do you know, I would tell you something, he said. Our dear friend was an old man, tired and ill, when he went off on that last journey. For days before he left, I was supposed to tell him that he could not go. I tried and I tried, but I could not tell him. Even on that last morning, I could not give the order. Father Pierre put his hands together in emotion. What could I have saved him from? From dying at his work? That is how we, all of us, want to die when our time comes. He looked earnestly at Guerra. But if he thought he would find the abstract pardon of life there, he was mistaken. Guerra simply looked back at him with the impersonal judgment of the world. No, I could not give the order, resumed Father Pierre. And do you know? I'm sure he knew what I had to say. He would not let me say it. He gave the orders. Just to prove it, he even sent me upstairs to find his green sunglasses. I went, and I did not find them. When I came down again, there they were. He had them all the time. Guerra laughed out loud at the crankiness this recalled, and what it meant. He bent over, took up the pair of green glass spectacles with their rusted tin rims, and with a gleam of meaning handed them to Father Pierre. Then keep these also, he said. Thank you, said the bishop-elect soberly.